From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 25 years ago, on a beautiful spring day, a flatbed pickup towing a two-ton hay baler crashed into a group of sorority sisters from the University of Mississippi out on a Kidney Foundation charity walk. Five were killed, many more injured. It was terrible. Paige Williams started that walk with her sorority sisters, but returned to campus early. Now, a quarter century on, she's been thinking about how it was to lose so many friends when they and she were still so young. This hour on Point, when death hits young, you can join the conversation. Have you been young and lost a peer? How do we deal with that, live with it, in the neighborhood, on the battlefield, in the family, in a sisterhood? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Paige Williams. She's a National Magazine award-winning journalist, teaches narrative writing at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. Her essay in the May issue of O Magazine is headlined, "We Thought the Sun Would Always Shine on Our Lives." Paige Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us today from Atlanta, Georgia, is Vanessa Jackson. She's a clinical social worker at Healing Circles, her private practice, and a former counselor at Washington University Student Health Services. Vanessa Jackson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom, for having me.
Vanessa, I want to share with our listeners some of Paige's stories, hear your own, and then get into this issue of sort of the life cycle of grief, especially when it comes young. Paige, I wish you'd take us back. There you were, Ole Miss. This is northern Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And sorority sisters out on the kind of charity walk that many, many, many people do around the country these days. But without, in this particular year, 1987,
mm-hmm.
of course, without the police escort that they had, just one of the sisters' Toyota Camry sort of going along behind.
Nissan Maxima,
with the flashing lights on.
Right.
And a lot of girls walking on the edge, on the shoulder mm-hmm. of the highway, Route 6 there. I know that terrain. And here comes a pickup with a hay baler. I know hay balers. They're big. They're ungainly. And this terrible. It hits the car behind them. Everything flies into all those girls.
Right.
How many injured?
There were 20 there at the time. And almost everyone was down. There were four or five left standing, and they were the girls who were walking the farthest out front of the group. And then there were a few girls directly in front of the car who just happened to look around and see it, and see the wreckage coming,
yeah.
and could run or dodge yeah. it a little bit. So they were hurt. They were hit, nevertheless, but were not quite.
Terrible injuries as well.
I mean,
you talk about you got
injuries,
grievous. Yes. You talk about a pickup truck and this big, heavy, ungainly hay baler and chains spiked right to pick the hay up off the field and mm-hmm. all that flying through the air into this cluster of young mm-hmm. women.
Right, and we were walking together. They, mm-hmm. the girls who were there at the time, we mm-hmm. were walking in shifts of about 20,
mm-hmm.
and this happened at around 2:30 in the afternoon.
Your shift had gone back to
campus.
My
shift started at 9 that morning,
mm-hmm.
And I had gone in for lunch. Yes. A couple hours before that, but they were, you know, when you're walking, you cluster together so that mm-hmm. you can talk about what's going on in your lives. And
sure.
we had just been to formal, and we were talking mm-hmm. about life. I mean, it was springtime in Mississippi. It was gorgeous.
And you were doing
day.
Something good. You were raising money for the Kidney Foundation.
Yes.
And then this big and bad thing happens. Now, the number of injuries and deaths, five mm-hmm. deaths here, it, overwhelming in any situation. I mean, that happens in five deaths in Afghanistan, we hear about it. Even in war, we hear about it. Never mind just on a pretty spring day in Mississippi. So presumably the first reaction of people was just kind of horror and being overwhelmed at what happened.
Astonishment. No one could quite believe it, and we certainly couldn't make sense of it. It didn't seem possible. And we had lost people in our lives. I mean, there were girls who had lost their parents to cancer or to mm-hmm. Other horrific things.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly we knew loss, but we did not know catastrophic loss, and we didn't know group loss. So, and the fact that two of the girls died there on the highway, and then mm-hmm. three more, mm-hmm. one died in the chopper on the way to Memphis, and then two more died the next morning in the trauma unit in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just this chain reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, two were dead immediately, and then one after
and on it came, and on it came into that community,
right?
And others with their terrible losses. Now, you describe how people who were sort of full-grown adults of that at that time have dealt with this. Terrible for them. You describe the father who goes back year after year to paint those five white crosses by the road there. But for those of you who were their peers in age, for whom, yes, you might have known some difficulty, but this was something different. You've gone back 25 years later to see how people managed and began to share with us. How did it, in the early years, did it affect people right away? Did it change the trajectory of their young lives?
You know, it's a good question, and I think that it depends on the person that you ask. What's striking to me now, these many years later, is the fact that we didn't talk about it. We didn't go back and discuss any of this. We went back to school the next, you know, Monday. Mm. We went back to school Monday, and we were wearing these black ribbons on our shirts. But other than that, we didn't really, to my knowledge, as far as I remember, maybe I've blocked it, I don't know.
You're 20 years old, you didn't really talk it through.
No, and you know, the White House sent in the National Office of Victims Assistance Crisis Team and
the grief counselors,
they sat
in. It was a big deal at that
they
time.
They sat in a room at the student union, and I think no one came. I think that nobody really took advantage of the time to, of the
Because it was too
to
overwhelming? Because did people say to you, don't get lost in the grief here. Move on, Paige. Move on, girls.
No, I don't think so. I think it just was not discussed, period. And it wasn't for lack of trying. I think some adults did try. I remember a chapter advisor trying to get us to open up about it. My own mother said, please tell me. Tell me what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what happened. And she and my sister, Tracy, my sister was a freshman, and a Chi-O along with us. And
Chi-O,
neither
this
of us
was your sort of was Chi-Omega.
Chi-Omega, right. And neither of us, which, according to my mom, would talk about it at all. So I think we must have just shut down on some level. And there was plenty. Ole Miss made available to us much counseling and much help, but we just didn't. We just went back to our classes and back to our parties. And
life went on, and went on for a long time at this point, 25 years. And
right.
Paige Williams has looked at and gone back to talk with some of the then young women, now in the middle of their lives, about how it affected them. Vanessa Jackson, so good of you to be listening with us, and I know you have experience of your own with this, both directly and with others. And sometimes we roll past it as society because we think of this as an end of life or later in life, but when you add up the circumstances, whether they're just accidental, like we see in this case, or on the battlefield where so many young Americans have been for a lot of the last decade, or in harm's way in this country, tough neighborhoods, or just bad luck. There are plenty of young people who have to deal with this, Vanessa, of young peers blinking out, going away.
Absolutely, and certainly here in Atlanta. And first I wanted to say, Paige, I so appreciate the beautiful and powerful way that you are telling the story.
Thank you.
Providing an opportunity for people to think about a topic that oftentimes never gets talked about, because grief out of season, and let me just say up front, we don't do grief very well in this culture at all. Mm. Whether it's the 3 days off if there's a death, then back to work, and we try to respond to that. And so certainly as young people, and as I was reading this article, it sort of also touched on a couple things in my own personal life and what I have used in my therapy as well, which was in my sophomore, I believe, year of college, two of my sorority sisters were in a car wreck where one was injured and the other died. And I remember us going to this little rural town, and my friend Karen's parents were pig farmers, and she had once brought one of the pigs to school. And just being sort of overwhelmed about how, you know, 19-year-olds, how do I talk to this woman's mother?
Yeah.
How do I talk, you know? So it is very overwhelming. But I think that the other time is that, and you know, Paige, you're also saying that resources were made available. But at this time, it was sort of like, I don't know how to use these, or I need to get back in my life.
Right. Yes.
And And I think that that oftentimes happens, but I think even in your writing, what it says, it's never too late to grieve. And I think that is really what I was reading the article is just a beautiful, beautiful reminder that no matter how overwhelming and catastrophic, it's never too late to grieve. And I certainly see a lot of clients who have had sibling deaths. I had a sibling death of a suicide when I was 24, but also people who have had victims of violent crime. Horrendous circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And sort of trying to figure out how to create your life and move forward your life around that, what I would call a wound. And it's an invisible wound oftentimes. And so I just think it's really important for us to understand that grief is an ongoing process and that it's never too late to go back and do another layer of exploration.
And as you call it, Vanessa, particularly difficult, maybe when it's grief out of season, when it's just pain, a wound out of season. Paige Williams has gone back and talked with a lot of the then girls, young women now, women in the middle of their lives about exactly what happened there. We're going to look at that. Did they welcome a return to thinking about this, Paige, when you came back to them? Was there a rule of thumb?
The rule of thumb was that it was sort of a taboo topic, and
even 25 years later.
Even 25 years later. In fact, some actively lobbied against this piece being done because, I mean, the fear is valid. You know, we were worried about reopening that wound. We thought the wound was closed, as Vanessa just says. Mm-hmm. It's never really closed. Mm-hmm. So there was some opposition, but then most of the girls, when we started talking, it turned out to be a good thing. And
in many ways, for many people, even the dead never entirely go away.
No.
They stay with us in their own way. We'll look at that as well. Paige Williams is writing in O Magazine, "We thought the sun would always shine on our lives, and then five blinked out, snuffed out." Vanessa Jackson is with us from Atlanta, Georgia. Listeners, you can join us. Have you lost a friend you thought was too young to die? How did you grieve? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the life cycle of grief and what it means to lose a peer when you're young. It can happen and does happen in many circumstances. My guest today, Paige Williams, was a college student at Ole Miss, University of Mississippi, 25 years ago when five of her sorority sisters were killed in a terrible accident on a single day. She's gone back to remember that day and think about the years since and how she and others have handled the long work of grieving and coming to terms with an out-of-season death, as our other guest, my other guest, Vanessa Jackson, calls it. She's a clinical social worker with Healing Circles in Atlanta, Georgia, and joins us from Atlanta today. Listeners, you can join us, and many are here already online, but has this happened to you? When a death out of season appear when you were young, how did you work through it? Did it derail you for a while? Has it surprised you over the years how and when it pops up? Do you still feel the presence of those long gone in a good way? And what brings it back? The grief, them? What's the trigger? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Got lots of responses online here. Yar says, "I lost a friend when I was in fourth grade. He fell off a cliff on a camping trip. I realized life is precious and strange. I think about him several times a year as if he's followed me through my entire life." Brett says, "My fiancé was killed in a car accident in 1987, same year, Paige. It took about 2 years to work through the grief and begin to really live again. I'd say with such a loss, 2 years is a good time frame, but you've got to remember those five stages of grief. You don't go cleanly from one to the next. There's a lot of moving back and forth." And Brett adds, you know, "One thing that was not helpful to him was when people said the Lord works in mysterious ways. It's nonsense. If anything, what loss teaches us is the power of randomness in the universe." Another listener says, "Death happens, and it's something we have in common, but the thing to do is give your regards and move on. Focusing on death of a loved one or lost one is not healthy." We'll talk about exactly how that works as well. Let me get a couple callers, and we'll come back to your story, Paige. Spokane, Washington. Taylor's calling. Taylor, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Last year, I'm 20, mm-hmm. and I had a few friends pass away. There's three of them in the car. what had happened was I came home from my grandpa's funeral from Idaho, and mm-hmm. I was going to go hang out with them the night they got in the car wreck, but, you know, I was just kind of feeling down from the funeral, so I said not to, and the next day I go over to my friend's, and he was on the phone with the police, and they had told him that Tony and Joe were dead, and they were asking if they knew who the third person was because he didn't have any identification on. Mm-hmm. So right after that, we went over to Tony's mom's, and we went all around, and I told my mom about it, and she called another one of her friends, Isaac, and said, "Did you hear about Tony and Joe?" And he goes, "Yeah, that's weird, because my brother was with them last night, and he didn't come home, and it ended up that his big brother had been in the car, too." Mm-hmm.
Taylor, how did their families must have been just wrecked at that time. How have you dealt with it at 20? Did it sort of throw you off your game plan? Did you take time out? Did you just keep going on?
Well, yeah, I would have been actually like 19 at the time. It was last year. But the hardest part was watching the family, the mother. That was definitely the hardest. I guess for my game plan, I wasn't college bound at the time. I'm in college now, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess we partied a lot and stuff. So, I mean, it might have helped me more than anything to be like, they were drinking and stuff. So I think it scared me and kind of made me want to do better, I guess.
Yeah.
At
mm-hmm.
the time where I was at.
It may end up protecting your life in some way. We'll look at that dynamic. If I may, let me get Jody in Guilford, Vermont. Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's actually Dodie with a D, but...
Good.
I wanted to tell you about my friend Diana. She died at 11 from leukemia, and I remember her telling me that she was sick, and she didn't look sick at all, and she said she had a grown-up disease, and then a short time later, my mom told me that Diana had died.
How long ago was that, Dodie?
50 years.
Okay.
I'm 61 now, and sometimes I'm surprised myself. I didn't know her that well, but I remember thinking after she died that how strange and weird that was, somebody so young could die, and thinking about what life really meant. And at a very young age, I decided that when you die, if even one person remembers you for something that you did with them or for them, that was what the meaning of life would be about. And I've talked about Diana to friends and through grief situations my entire life, and a couple of years ago I had the chance to see her now very elderly stepmother, who I'd mm-hmm. known quite well at the time, mm-hmm. and to tell her how much Diana had stayed with me and affected the whole course of my life. And of course she was thrilled that somebody had remembered Diana, but
of course
she was the first person I knew that died, and she's lived on in my heart ever since.
That is amazing. Mm-hmm. Died, but not died in so many ways. Dodie, thank you for sharing that. Taylor and Dodie, and one more. Andrew, thank you, Dodie. Clarksville, Tennessee. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say I spent several years in the Army, and there's a huge contrast of loss of people that we lost at home in garrison for due to accidents or whatever, and losing people overseas in combat. We lost a really good friend of mine, got killed in a car accident. He was hit by a drunk driver driving to work at 5-6 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it was harder to deal with that loss than it actually was to deal with the loss of another close friend that we lost in Afghanistan to enemy fire.
Because on the battlefield, you somehow accept it as the terms of existence.
Exactly. You don't want it. You don't expect it every time you go out, but you understand that it's a possibility. And when you lose people at home, it's just a complete and utter shock, because here at home, we're supposed to be safe. This is where we're supposed to be, you know, family time and,
right.
and training and discipline and, you know, being a soldier, absolutely, but it's also, you shouldn't have to worry about being killed here at home.
Yeah.
So it's harder to deal with.
Yeah. Andrew, I appreciate your sharing that as well. Vanessa Jackson, I'm just thinking about the range of things here, and you must have seen many cases in the course of your career. But, you know, here there's the battlefield situation, and many young people face that. We have kind of equivalents in some places of battlefields in this country where violent death is not uncommon. Then there's early illness and death. And then there's this kind of just out of the blue, whether it's by drunk driving, or which wasn't the case in Paige's case, just a terrible accident, just out of the blue. What about the range of circumstances that can lead to this, and how the different, or for that matter, I'm looking here, you know, just today, what was 13 people charged in the death of Robert Champion, who was in the marching band. The kid was hazed to death. They're now charging. How do these different circumstances affect how people respond to this sudden young challenge?
I think that it's really, first of all, the grief process is so different for every single person. You could even have people in the same family and everybody take a different sort of position about how they're going to move through the experience. And it's sort of like the caller was just saying, there is a sort of extra level of shock when there is the perception that we should be safe. And certainly as young people, I mean, it's not so difficult to believe that we're indestructible, or at least not have our heads in that direction. And in fact, I think that's really as it should be on some level. So there is sort of the extra layer processing of just this was not supposed to happen, which is both a confusion and an outrage. Mm-hmm. And then there are certain kind of deaths, I think, that also people's response to them get more confusing. Suicides can be very confusing for people. And there, as I said, there's a social sort of awkwardness around death about we don't want to hurt people. We don't want to bring up bad memories. Mm. But so often when we do that, we take away, because what I think, in fact, what you even created today was a sort of a community kind of conversation about death out of season. And I think most people would probably say is we don't really have a lot of opportunities to talk about this. And so I just think that certain deaths become a little bit more challenging because people feel so uncomfortable with the nature of the death. Mm-hmm. And then there's just a general fear about death. And I think that the hospice movement has done a lot of beautiful work around sort of helping people to understand the process of dying and sort of helping people begin to shape what their belief is about what happens afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a difference. If I have a belief that that the relationship continues, I love how Snow talked about sort of bringing the girls along with her in her life.
Snow, one of the young women who Paige was in college with, who found her way. Paige, share that with us. And if we may, sort of the range of ways over time, the first shock shut a lot of people down. But over time, what did you find was the range of ways that these women through the course of their lives responded to that day of death?
Snow Wilkes is the young woman you're talking about, and if you'll see when you read the piece that she was one of the ones left standing. In fact, her two best friends were taken literally from right beside her. She was walking next to
like
two
inches away.
Inches.
They were swept by the hay baler.
Literally inches. Mm-hmm. Like they were just taken, like a tornado takes away, you know, half a house and leaves the other half. She dealt with it in ways that I'll let the piece explain. But the other
tell
girl,
us enough that we can
enough. Okay,
get a sense.
I think she was angry at first and really withdrew at first and refused to talk about it. Even when we tried to draw her in closer, she didn't know what to do with the fact that she had survived. She felt guilty. She felt like she had to make her life count five times over because she was left. She did the, you know, the religious counseling thing for a while, the ministry thing for a while. Then she became a nurse, and so she cared for other people in that capacity. And
does she tie that course of her life back to the event of that day?
I asked her that, and she had not thought about it in that way.
Interesting.
I know. And there's another guy, the guy Todd, who came upon the accident and put his shirt, took off his clothes, and put his shirts over the bodies.
Some of the worst
of
wounds
the two.
There. Just
horrific. And he went into healthcare also. And I asked him whether he went into healthcare because of this, and he said he hadn't thought about it. He didn't know. So I think some of these connections, we're not quite aware of how this thing went to work on our lives.
And what about you? What about the course of, I don't know, whether it's work and career or your sense of those young women who died, how in work, in emotion, how's it stayed with you, Paige?
Well, I think that my students would say that all I ever give them in terms of reading material is death, stories about death. I think I've developed this, it's probably an unhealthy interest in the subject. But it's fascinating to me to hearing Vanessa talk about this is really interesting to me because mm-hmm. I think it's just not something – death is not something that we have figured out how to discuss in a sort of – authentic way. That's the only way. I mean, we mm-hmm. hear these platitudes, like the guy that said a minute ago, oh,
mysterious ways.
The Lord works. Mm-hmm. No, that was the worst mm-hmm. thing that somebody could say. You know, in the South especially, they'll say, oh, well, God just needed another angel in heaven. Mm-hmm. That never sat right with me. That didn't explain anything to me. And that's the shorthand that we use for this was supposed to happen. This was part of the plan, and it just never – for some people, that's fine.
And yet some people turn to religion and find solace so deep there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is a great comfort to some people. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a great comfort to most people. Mm-hmm. I think other people find the subject a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, no kidding. Here's online people – I mean, you know, it seems distant, but it's not. It is the surround of life. Mike says, I lost my wife when she was 25. We'd been married 4 years. I never miss an anniversary, and we would have been married 43 years next month. You know, always mark. Grace, when I was 22, my four-month-old son died. It was very strange to be faced with decisions that I just assumed were the realm of someone else, someone older. Vanessa, for the young, there is that. There's the sense that this should not be part of my life, the out-of-season part you mentioned.
And I think feeling ill-prepared, and you know, Paige, as you said, I think you have... I don't think it's an unhealthy interest in death. I am.
Good to know.
You talk about how this experience has worked on everybody, even if it's not fully conscious, to be able to bring forward and to create a national conversation like we're doing right now about death, which allows people to show up and hear if they're not ready to speak, and to be able to speak about folks that are long lost to them, but who are very, very present in their life. And so I think it's really some very, very powerful work, because if we get clear about death, not trying to rush to embrace it, but it's one of my favorite pictures is a picture of a bare-breasted woman, and it says, accept your own death to become dangerous. Because when you don't have that fear, or you have an understanding that that's going to be happening, and it's incredibly random. And I especially say when, you know, it must be God's will, and that's one of those lines that's very infuriating to me. Mm-hmm. And the better question of it is I'm sorry, and as people move through, is what meaning does this have for you? And not in the sense of it was supposed to happen, but the mm-hmm. sense of what meaning was I able to make of this mm-hmm. in my life as I move through this thing that I never, ever wanted to have happen.
And you have you that know? Image of the woman taking courage somehow from it, or bravery, because why not? Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. Mike, you're on the air.
Mm-hmm. Hi. I'm in my early 60s, and when I was in 20 and in college, I was involved in a head-on car accident. Somebody got on the freeway the wrong way and hit our car head-on, and two people died in the other car, and three people died in my car, and I was one of six that survived. And the unusual part for me, and I guess it's because I didn't know the kids that well. I just I went home with a friend that I had just met recently in college, went home for the weekend, and that's when we were involved in the car accident. But I felt bad for it. I'm a compassionate person, mm-hmm. but there was nothing residual that lasted from it.
Do you think that was in part an attribute of youth as well, Mike, that you could kind of, you know, they weren't your buddies, you didn't know them that well, it happened, and youth allowed you to move on?
Not exactly. Yep, and it was just like, when I think back on it, it was just like, oh well, that's, you know, I'm surprised when I look. I have an old newspaper clipping of it, and it was a horrible accident, and the cars were just, you know, it was just horrendous. But I just don't have any feeling for it. However, the kid that I went home with, I still remember his name clearly, and I can still kind of picture him. But other than that, I don't have any feeling. I feel bad for the people that died, of course, and of course their families. The mother mm-hmm. and father came to the hospital to see me when I was in the hospital. I remember that. And but I guess the lack of
Maybe the lack of connective tissue, the circumstances matter, the culture, the environment that surround your relationships with the dead obviously matter. Mike in Phoenix, I appreciate your call. Paige Williams, please stand by with me in the studio here, and Vanessa Jackson in Atlanta, Georgia. We're talking about grief out of season this hour, what it means when to lose a peer when you are young. 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life cycle of grief. Grief out of season and what it means to lose a peer when you are young. How the young deal with that. Paige Williams is with us. Her essay in the May issue of O Magazine is, "We Thought the Sun Would Always Shine on Our Lives." And it recounts how 25 years ago this year on a beautiful spring day, five of her sorority sisters out on a charity walk for the Kidney Foundation, five killed in one terrible accident there. You can link to that piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Vanessa Jackson joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. She's a clinical social worker there. Lots of experience in this field. And you can join us as well. How do you deal with the injustice of losing someone who was just beginning? And do we respect young grief enough? Are we too quick to say, move on? Or is that absolutely necessary? Does the setting matter, whether it's soldier or sorority sister or neighborhood friend? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. And it's remarkable how many people are responding to your piece here, Paige. You know, we always think of it, death is something off in a separate realm, but when you make it present, there are so many grappling with it at any one time. It's part of the surround of life. Elizabeth in Montreal, Canada. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. My twin brother committed suicide about 30 years ago. We were very close, especially towards the end. And a very strange story happened after that. He was having a couple of bad years, and I was taking care of him, and then, you know, he went and shot himself. But after that, about a month after that, a friend took me to Plattsburgh, New York, to just for a drive to play the horse races.
Mm-hmm.
And sorry, there was just another thing that I forgot that was very important. I'm Jewish, and in the Jewish religion, the number 18 is very important. So I always love the number 9 for me and 9 for my brother. So and
twin.
Together we met.
Mm-hmm.
It meant 18. Hi, life. It meant life. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my friend takes me to Plattsburgh, New York, and he asked me if I want to play the horse races. And I said, oh, my God, no, I just don't have the head for this. I waited outside, and my brother's name was Jerry, G.G.
Mm-hmm.
And so I waited outside, and when my friend came out with the racing program, he showed it to me. So I looked at the number 9 race, and it said Jerry G.G., and I still have that piece of paper to this day. So people tell me, well, did you win? And I said, what are you talking about? No, I didn't win money, but I won something. I was kind of euphoric, you know? It was a beautiful, wonderful, very mystical experience.
A kind of sense of connection in that moment, Elizabeth, mm-hmm. to the twin who you'd lost.
Oh yeah, and he was just a gentle, you know, beautiful boy, you know. We were quite young. We were in our 20s.
Yeah.
And I never felt anger, never felt resentment. I never felt blame. I didn't blame him. I never blamed myself. I never said why me. I felt he was in a lot of pain, and this is what he had to do, and I had to respect that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that enabled me to survive his death and still enjoy other people.
There's the generosity of a twin in some way, at some level there, Elizabeth. And I appreciate your call. Thank you so much from Montreal. Vanessa, what have you found about the ways people keep the connection alive to those who are gone?
I think that that's really essential, and I just loved Elizabeth's story because I was sort of thinking about my own story, about those sort of mystical experiences as well. Oftentimes people in dreams, and what I always ask people when they're coming in around grief is, what are your traditions if there are spiritual traditions, family traditions around grieving, and is there anything in that tradition that allows you to keep the memory of that person alive? And if there is, then that's what we're going to be working with. But also, I think we look for signs of confirmation that people are okay, that they know we're okay. Whether I had a dream once with my sister where I felt dropped and a big hand caught me, and my knowing was that she's got me and I'm okay, and she needs me to be okay right now. She's good. So I just think that also looking at your different traditions about what – and I love the Jewish tradition because, as I said, I think oftentimes we have this three-day, three-week kind of thinking in our culture, and I think that year of the unveiling and having prayers and having this really powerful opportunity and communal opportunity.
A year later coming back.
Yeah. But what it does say is we don't expect you to have your legs back under you fully.
Mm-hmm.
We know you need to get on
time
with your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. You do have to get on that, whether you go back to school or go to classes, but that you're having to do your life holding this grief, and I think that's always the difficulty. And then when you get a tradition that lets you say, we know you need to go through birthdays and holidays, and you need to hold your breath that first couple years, even maybe, mm-hmm. to know how you're going to feel.
And that's all right.
But that we're, and that's all right. And so I think, so when I talk to people come in who are not Jewish, I said, I want to tell you about this tradition, because I think that there is a way that it does give people permission to feel kind of off, even as you go about your regular life, and that sort of sadness stays right there with the happiness and an affirmation of your own life. So I just think that there's lots of different things. And when people come to see me, it's like, mm-hmm. we are going to figure out what your grief process looks like. There's no, it doesn't have to look at anyone. There's no one right way to do it, but you have to do it. No one gets out without doing it.
Yeah. Paige, did you find that your sorority sisters in this case, do they have different ways, and did they produce different outcomes of what they had dealt with there?
Everyone, in terms of outcome, I was most interested in how, where they were at this point in their lives 25 years mm-hmm. later, and whether this event had undone them or whether it had led to something profoundly, you know, good. They all are doing really, really well. And I asked each of them how they got there, and unfailingly they said it was their families and their faith, every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that process looked like for mm-hmm. them, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like Vanessa's saying, it's a very individual thing.
You know, I'm reading here a comment from a listener online, Vanessa Page. This is from Raymond. He says, I lost a grandmother at 7 and a grandfather at 9. This can't be that uncommon. But he says, unlike my wife, who never lost anyone until she was nearly 30, these early deaths, along with the everyday life and death that goes on a dairy farm where Ray grew up, taught me early on about the inevitability of death, how to deal with it, how not to fear it. And then Kristen writes in behind Raymond here, says, I lost multiple people when I was younger. She says, I agree with Raymond. Witnessing death at an early age taught me that death was a part of life and not something to fear. Vanessa, do you see a difference when young people suddenly face this between those who have already confronted it maybe in season in their life with grandparents or others whose passing you might expect? Has it made their accommodating grappling with death easier?
I think that more experienced people have. It depends again. It's so unique. I can't even say there's a common mm-hmm. way of saying. I can't even answer that because how the deaths happen and what I tell adults oftentimes, especially when there's young people involved, is oftentimes kids will take their cues from what how the parents are doing grief. Because
yes,
parents will get very frightened, and so it's like, it's a good time to create a family communal ritual around that. Because I think community, you know, Paige, you talk about family and faith, and I would add community, that is ultimately, so people, when we have the vigils and the crosses and that every year going back and painting them, is that father's ritual of acknowledgement and grief. But it also, by them being there, and when we drive, I know when I drive down the highway and see those markers, mm-hmm. there's a way that I pause in my life, and it reminds me that life is fragile. And so if we can get sort of more comfortable with the, I mean, I remember talking to a client one time about, she goes, well, if my parents die, and I said, let me stop you. What do you mean if?
Mm.
But and that tells you how disconnected we are. So I think that the more spaces that we can create, and I think this offering of this story is a powerful way to say, how do we bring death is part of life. And in the past, when people had to prepare bodies, mm-hmm. that there was
they
a
knew
way
it.
That
it was
death,
in the living
death,
room.
It was in the living room. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of pulled that further and further away, and illnesses were in the living room, in the mm-hmm. bedroom. And so I think we got disconnected, and I think we have to get reconnected because it is inevitable. It oftentimes happens out of season in incredibly random ways that we then spend the rest of our life trying to understand what that meant for us. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say one last thing is my father, we lost my sister to cancer, my mother to a sort of longstanding renal failure, and then my aunt to breast cancer in a 18-month period, and all of them died on the 20th of the month. So it was 20th of February, 20th of September, and 20th of May.
Wow.
I had grief fatigue too. And I think, and I know, and Paige, I don't know for you with sort of losing so many people, it was like it happened at once, but there's all these different levels of the connection. And you get tired of grieving.
Right.
It's tiring.
It's exhausting. It's exhausting, especially when you can't figure out how to get past it. And so you're mm-hmm. still mm-hmm. dealing with it years and years later. And whether it's the anniversary or you see someone who reminds you of someone that you lost, mm-hmm. and it starts all over again.
Did it help you to write about it after 25 years in such depth and detail?
You know, someone asked me that yesterday, and I am still – I don't know how to answer that. Not yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It may help us. Lisa in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Lisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My story is when I grew up with my best friend, Greg. We were best friends through our church until we were 16, and he was tragically killed in a car accident. And the way I found out was I talked to him the night before, actually the night it happened, and I was in church the next morning, and they made the announcement, which was devastating because nobody told me off to the side. I had to hear along with everybody else, which was devastating. And through the next few years, I went through a lot of anger. Why such a beautiful spirit? How did this happen? Same religious, you know, God needing another angel, which never sat well with me either. Just a lot of anger. I made a lot of bad choices, I think, because I didn't, you know, nobody talked with me about it. It was just, this happened, get over it. It's sad, but, and years later, I remember he's always stayed with me. And as I've grown older, I'm 47 now, I think what he could have had in his life. Mm-hmm. But 2 years ago, just a random, meeting, I was in Maine working as a bank teller. End of the day, a man comes in and another teller was waiting on him. And he made some comment about the state of Kansas, which perked me up because that's where this all happened. And I went over and I said, oh, I'm from Kansas. And we began talking. And he actually was a friend of Greg's family. And we had been at Greg's funeral together 30-some years ago. So it was nice to be able to
bring it back around.
Yeah, a tribute to his life. And so, I mean, it does stay with you, and it's totally a process of grief. I don't think you ever get over losing somebody that you love so much.
Lisa, I appreciate your call. And Perula writes online, I work with teens. I'm frustrated at the lack of listening skills of so many adults. Kids tell me all the time how they wish they could speak to their parents, but when they do, they get a lecture. When a young person suffers a loss, it's critical to be where they are, hear them, empathize with their fears and depressions, not sermonize or minimize or belittle their pain. You can hear that. Let me get one here, Kate in Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My story goes back to 1975, so I was 15, and it was it's become somewhat of a famous public story, but it was a personal thing at the time. And there was a girl named Martha Moxley who was killed by another kid, and we all kind of knew, we thought we knew who had done it. And the next day we went to school, and that kid had literally left the country. And so there was all this talk among the kids, and there was nothing in the newspaper. There was no grief counseling or anything at that time. Mm-hmm. So there was this very strange kind of trying to sort things out on our own. And, you know, the guy who was eventually charged, and you'll still hear his appeals this many years later, and I'm not judging the case. I'm just saying what we thought at the time.
This was the nephew of Ethel Kennedy, that whole story.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so years later, I was sort of pondering it and thinking about the impact of it in my life. And a friend of mine who was even closer to Martha, I was in her homeroom, but my friend was closer. And you know, she did become she went to religion immediately and became a born again Christian. But just this idea that like a young beautiful girl could die by at the hands of somebody from a powerful family, and then they would just, you know, life would just go on, and that's what can happen, you know. And I think it was just, I really think it affected us in a deep way, that like your life can be erased, and if someone is connected to power, and that was our perception, then you know, that's kind of too bad. That's the way it shakes out. And it was Greenwich, Connecticut, and yeah. And there somebody else, they said it was a vagrant who sort of wandered off the highway, and he was probably black, you know, because it was a pretty racist environment, and it was very, very strange. And the only other point I'll make quickly is that I felt like I, in some ways, became an adult, because my mother, the day of the funeral, people went, but my friend who was closer to Martha didn't want to go. She doesn't like funerals. She wanted to sort of think of Martha in her own private way, and I called my mother to say, we're not going to go to school. We're going to just kind of go to the beach and talk about Martha. And my mother said, absolutely not. You know, if you're not going to the funeral, you're going to school. And I said, well, you know, actually, I think this is the right thing to do. And it was a very much a defining moment where my mother, I just said, I had been afraid of my mother, but I said, no, this is the right thing to do, and I'm going to do that.
There were things you needed to do, Kate, and it sounds like it's a good thing you did. Kate, our time is just going from us here, but I appreciate your call so much. And Paige, Vanessa, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just wanted to stop, and I just love that story, because I think, and especially with young people, is when I worked in a mental health center, we had a number of kids that were sort of quote-unquote acting out, and as I start to bring the therapist together, we realized that every single one of these children had lost somebody, whether it was siblings or parents or grand, and they were just profoundly grieving, and so we ended up doing a group, I was facilitator, called Good Grief. And it was an 8-week group, and we brought, and it was just for the young people, because they did not have the spaces in their lives to do their processing. And I remember, though, because I think people expect it to be very sad and, you know, depressing. Mm-hmm. And one day the therapist says, oh, I always know when your grief group is in the house because there's so much laughter.
Good grief.
Because part of it was about trying to reclaim their joy, but also give them ways to talk about and make meaning and create a place in their life. And I'd say the thing, I didn't finish my father's story, because what I said to me was, he feels sad. On the days he feels sad, he feels sad. And if he doesn't feel sad, he doesn't feel sad. And I kept thinking, that's kind of basic. But yeah, feel what you feel when you feel it.
And so. There's good grief, but don't have to pretend that it's all
right.
That it's all good.
No.
Paige Williams here from Twitter, a comment from Caroline. Listening to my Chi Omega sister, Paige Williams, on Point Radio on Vermont Public Radio and crying all over the place. So proud to be her sister. It's hard to recount these stories, but there's gratitude right there to you, Paige, for bringing it back. And we hope in this 25th year since then you're finding some peace with it yourself.
Thank you.
The story is at our website, onpointradio.org. Paige Williams with the Nieman Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Vanessa Jackson at Healing Circles in Atlanta. Thank you, Vanessa.
Well, thank you for letting me come here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.